Right now, it is time to welcome in David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast it over the weekend as well. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. Also, he's a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and we're always pleased to have him here on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello there. It's good to be checking in bright and early with the indefatigable Marshall Miles, and I'm reporting again, back again, to the media capital of the world, New York City. I'm back from the so-called British Isles, which of course includes Ireland, I keep stressing, because I was in the Irish part of the British Isles. But I should report that media on both sides of the Atlantic this week have been recognizing and honoring the contributions made by members of the armed forces, sometimes even including the ultimate sacrifice of giving their life. Here, of course, in this side of the Atlantic, it's known as Veterans Day. In Europe, it's Armistice Day, ever since Armistice was declared to mark the end of the First World War. And in Britain, it's got another name, too, Remembrance Day, particularly Remembrance Sunday over this following weekend, when the Queen traditionally lays a wreath on behalf of the whole nation. The news I bring from Britain is that she is doing the wreath laying this year. It was abandoned last year because of COVID, of course, like so many ceremonies. And much of the time this fall, the Queen has just not been doing official events of any kind on the advice of her doctors. But she's been declared fit for this national duty. So we will see that as normal at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, marking Armistice Day, which, of course, is traditionally the 11th day of the 11th month, and when we shall remember them, as the European phrase goes.
You know, this year in America, and we talked about this yesterday, was the first time in 20 years. Now, we have troops all over the globe, but this is the first time in 20 years where Veterans Day was honored, and the veterans were honored, and we were not actively involved in the war in Afghanistan.
Sure, 20 years, extraordinary. It was once called the Forever War, a phrase that kept being used. Well, even forever wars can end. And it didn't end well, we know that, and lots of recriminations are still being enacted, and second-guessing still going on, especially in the media, but elsewhere too. In the realm of politics, I think it's going to stay with us as a hot issue. It'll cool a little, but it'll still be a very sensitive area for political discussion about how America conducted that war, and perhaps more than anything else, what will come up for review again and again is how America left Afghanistan.
And, you know, and what should be talked about when you take a major business any place in the world, when something they try doesn't work out, they first thing they do is they sit down, do an autopsy on why it didn't work out, and then they plan. You would think that our Senate and our Congress would get together with the Department of Defense and find a way that something like a 20-year war in a country that is basically unmanageable won't happen again.
Yeah, you and I, Marshall, share about 50 years each in the media business. I can just quote back at you that phrase you just used, which must be the most dangerous phrase to use ever in the media. You would think.
Yeah,
you would think people would do that. You would think many sensible things would happen and should happen, but I'm afraid that's just not the case. There has been much talk, I mean, in at the end of wars such as Vietnam, of doing a thoroughgoing post-mortem, and with the appalling attack on the United States on 9/11 2001, there was a national commission established established, and that sort of went into the business of how that terrible event happened, and certain weaknesses were extensively and thoroughly revealed in that commission, and some actions were taken, though in retrospect it doesn't seem to have made an awful lot of difference, although there has not been another terrorist attack on that scale or of that kind against the mainland of the United States, the homeland, as it became known, when one of the measures taken in the wake of the attacks was to create the Department of Homeland Security. And nowadays, of course, there has to be, and there continues to be, a large question mark over the usefulness of that sprawling department. One of the things that came through again and again in the commission's report was how little separate, agencies, government agencies involved, and having responsibility for defending the nation against that kind of attack, were all operating in their own individual silos, and the lack of communication between the different agencies was one of the recurring themes, as I say, of the criticism. It doesn't seem that that has been entirely healed by any means at all.
And you would think, because the Congress of the United States constantly, when a Democrat's in power and then also when a Republican's in power, the Congress always bemoans the fact that the office of the president has taken so much when it comes to war, power away from the Congress. You would think that, seeing as both sides complain when the other side is in and does it, that something would get done. But once again, I won't think about it at all anymore.
Well, you would think. Yeah. It's that dangerous phrase again. Politics is the art of the possible, it says, and it would appear that real honest self-reflection is not all that possible in our institutions, especially on matters as vital as this. That is the way it goes. I mean, so many people are invested in the history, so many people are invested in decisions that were taken, and it's hard to get a thoroughgoing examination of exactly what went wrong. Behind which the whole nation can then get. I mean, it's another reflection, I think, of the extreme polarization of our society as a whole now.
Let's move on to the courts. First of all, there's a dangerous situation that's developing in the Rittenhouse trial. The judge anybody that looks at this and thinks that this judge is handling this properly needs to fix their glasses. This trial, if Rittenhouse is let go, will explode race relations in this country.
It's alarming, indeed, the conduct of this case. it's a challenge for court reporters. There is so much that reporters cannot say about what's going on. Kyle Rittenhouse is on trial for murder, two murders and one attempted murder involves the charges of him shooting three people and killing two of them. What's been excluded from being heard in the court, in open court with the jury present, is a matter of extreme concern. And what has been reported, what can be reported, because it is very clearly happening in open court, is the behavior of the judge. The behavior of the judge seems to have become the focus of much of the reporting, and his approach towards the his behavior in reaction, I suppose, to the prosecutor, the main prosecutor in the case, is to say the least remarkable. Judge Bruce Schroeder is 75 years old. He's the most experienced murder judge in the state of Wisconsin, and he's a character in the sense that he makes himself, he has made himself in previous cases, but now more than ever, it seems, is making himself the center of attention. giving us lectures on European history at certain points in the trial too, that kind of thing. And as he says himself, he usually begins a trial by talking about himself, and often his wife too, and he, in this case, was no exception. But his altercations with the main prosecutor are the matters of greatest concern. The prosecutor not unusually, I mean, this often happens when it's clear that a court, and that means, of course, in the personage of the judge himself or herself, makes a ruling about what evidence can be included. That always cramps the capacity of the prosecutor to make a clean and convincing case, and of course it's a principle that is hallowed in the U.S. justice system. We are talking here about the exercise and the protection of the rights of the defendant. Those are very, very important. But what any self-respecting an agile prosecutor will do in a case like this is try and bring up the salient points of the excluded evidence in any way that they can. And the way that the prosecutor decided to try and do that was to hint at certain things, and then what we saw was the extraordinary and far from decorous explosion by the judge against the prosecutor, and other things too, like the terminology that the judge has allowed in the case, that the dead individuals, dead and injured individuals, cannot be referred to in summing up on the prosecution side as victims. Interestingly, the judge has decreed that they can be called rioters, but they cannot be called victims. This has the distinct smack of a certain kind of bias from the judge, and that's very alarming. And you know, one of the most alarming parts of it is that because of the judge's own decision about what to exclude and what terminology to allow, it's a reflection, as ever, of course, that in a court of law, the judge is the highest authority, and in many ways, unless there's an appeal involved, that cannot be questioned, that authority. So we've got the makings here of a likely verdict next week, which will look extremely unreliable, at the very least. And unsurprisingly, it's being made known to the media. No official statements, of course, but the briefings off the record are coming out now from the prosecution side, that lesser charges against Rittenhouse are in the making now, and that's what will happen. And as you fear, Marshall, in making your own warning sounds, it could be a verdict which sparks fury in the public at large, and that's never to be welcomed when a judicial finding, in this case a verdict clearly guided in certain ways very firmly by the judge, is found to be off or highly questionable when it comes to the final conviction or otherwise at the end of the proceedings.
And in another court case, a temporary win for the former president. Once again, he's got a short-term delay for the documents to be turned over to the January 6th committee. This is also a kind of an amazing story to look at.
Well, a small victory I guess. I mean, but any kind of judgment at the moment that favors the really extraordinary positions being adopted by the former president when it comes to releasing documents and having members of his staff and even just members of his own private circle subpoenaed to appear in the congressional investigation of what happened on January 6th with the riot and incursion into the Capitol building. Anything that looks like anything different from a defeat, because of course what he's been experiencing so far is a series of defeats, but this looks like, if not actually a victory, at least a delay in the process, so that might end up in another defeat, of course. Basically, it's a delay while the appellate court can consider the argument of the former president and lawyers on behalf of his former staff and his former and members of his circle who weren't in office, and although they're claiming executive privilege in certain ways, they were not at the time members of the executive, the Trump administration. So it's a pause for more consideration, which is, you know, not a bad thing. It's always good to take the time to think things through carefully, especially if you're on the bench of an appellate court, and that's what we have now. The pause button hit, and it'll take a little longer. The deadline for the subpoenas to be carried out or to be answered was today. It's clearly not going to happen today, and the court will make its decision in due time. We'll see, but in the broad span of how the judicial system is treating the efforts of this congressional committee that is investigating the January 6th events, we're seeing time and time again that the courts don't have any patience for this executive privilege argument that Trump is attempting.
And once again, to add to this a triple threat, the trial on Ahmaud Arbery and his murder trial goes on as well. I mean, these are three big trials that have the potential to really shake up a great portion of the American population.
Sure, that polarized society that we were talking about a little earlier is having fresh meat, as it were, thrown at it almost every day now, and the court system is a theater for these arguments to be, even if they're not carried out in open, with a total degree of openness. I mean, in many ways, it's a subtext what's going on here. The polarization of the Trumpists versus the rest of society, if you like, that whole hardcore, 30-something percent who go along with the crazy arguments of the Trump organization, Trump World, shall we call it that? It looks very much like a division which underlies just about everything that gets into the public arena for debate and discussion. And the formality of a trial on specific charges is time and time again underwritten by this extraordinary polarization that we're suffering now, and will continue to suffer, I think, until somehow or other the political pendulum in the United States of America swings back again, which it has a history of doing, but it's never very clear how long it will take, how long these swings actually are.
And we'll go international here for a second or two. A U.S. journalist has now been sentenced to 11 years in jail in Myanmar.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. There's a bell tolls in our discussions just about every week, isn't it? For the idea of press freedom in different parts of the world. It's never easy reporting on a dictatorship, and you have a military dictatorship in Myanmar, and inevitably diplomatic efforts will be gearing up, or have already geared up, of course, very considerably to try and get the unfortunate journalist out. But this is, in a way, a sad reflection that this is happening all over the world. There are people essentially, not always journalists, but often exponents, people who are trying at least to exercise their right of free speech, which is so often denied in so many countries, and they end up paying the cost of imprisonment, sometimes torture, and behind the scenes, if American citizens are concerned in this, it'll be the United States Department of State, and behind the scenes, the efforts will be made to get these unfortunate people out, and often, you know, I'm thinking now of places like Iran. And other parts of the world where the struggle off camera, if you like, behind closed doors much of the time, the struggle goes on to get the people released. And, you know, it's a difficult balance to know how much of this to actively report publicly and how much, to what extent we leave the diplomats alone to get on with the delicate matter of getting people out of the grips of dictators and dictatorships that don't play by our normal democratic rules.
And we have the meeting on climate change, and even though it's more window dressing than not, it's still a good sign that the United States and China have talked it out and gotten together on a pledge. Now, whether or not it actually happens, but it shows that the United States and China have started talking again.
Well, that was extraordinary. In a 2-week conference, which was not graced by the head of state of the hosting country, by the way, because of that ill health question that is hanging over the Queen of England, she didn't actually put in. She was one of the heads of state who were scheduled to be there in Glasgow, Scotland, but wasn't able to appear. But the conference went on with each day, as we discussed last week, some well-rehearsed media efforts to manage the news, if you like, coming out of the conference, and it's heated up now as we speak this morning, on the day that the summit as a whole is coming to its close, and there's inevitably been from the British presiding officer of the summit an air each day as this day has been approaching of rising concern about getting agreements on various issues. The deadline is looming, what has been looming, and the cries are getting more strident from both the presiding officer and the Secretary General of the United Nations, it's the regular call that you get in these big public events. We've got to have an agreement by such and such a day and time. Deadlines are meant to concentrate the mind of everybody involved. Well, it looks now like we're getting an agreement which is going to be distinctly watered down. All the private briefings coming out of various national offices, the temporary offices in Glasgow, suggest that there's a lot of kicking of the can down the road, and that's what we're likely to see at the end of this event. Huge attention devoted to it, and I suspect, it's hard not to be a little bit cynical about this, once again, we'll end up with something of a damp squib at the end of the conference as a whole when this day ends.
David, it's always great to chat with you on a Friday. Have a good week, and we'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely.
David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. Once again, David's website is themediabeat.us.